All right, this is Dr. Greg Seltz right here. He is going to be talking about, or Gregory Seltz, and he's going to be talking about Set Free to Live Freely, the LCRL, and you becoming God's public servants for the sake of the culture and the gospel together. And he is a jalapeno lover. So let's give him a warm round of applause.
I've never had a better introduction than that. Listen, first of all, it's great to be here with you, and I'm going to talk to you about the privilege that you have of being God. You're citizens of this country, but you're actually God's people. So we're going to talk about two kingdom citizenship, how you can be useful in God's hands in America, because America's given you some freedoms. You need to learn how to put those freedoms to work. And so one of the things I am going to do is, now you've seen my buddy Caesar. Caesar, can you stand up for just a minute? And by the way, if you go by our booth, the Lutheran Center for Religious Liberty booth, you can get these cool glasses, lcrlfreedom.org, and you can talk to Caesar. Now, Caesar's also going to have, today he's going to have a microphone, and if you want to be on my radio show, you just need to answer the question, what does religious liberty mean to you? You just got to tell them, and if we'll pick, you got to give them your name, you got to give us permission, but then we have a radio program in D.C., and I'm going to talk about the fact that these are what the kids came up and said to us, this is what they thought was important, and we'll talk about why that is important on the radio program. So if you do want to be a part of that, go talk to Caesar. Remember, the goal is to keep Caesar in his place. That's the whole point. That's what we're going to talk about today. Set free to live freely. That's who you are in Jesus, okay? All I'm going to talk about today is the fact that God is at work. That's it. But you can be useful in his hands, but you need to understand how God works. And God works two different ways. It's called two kingdoms. Does anybody know what I mean when I say two kingdoms? Good. All right. Well, it's as simple as this. God is at work, but he works two different ways, to preserve the world and to save the world. That's it. That's two kingdom theology right there. But the preservation work is law work. It's God actually working through things like honor your father and your mother, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, that kind of stuff. It doesn't save us, but it keeps all hell from breaking loose in our country. And God actually has a role for you to play in that regard too. Let me give you a metaphor. I try to, so that you can keep this easy in your mind. On a football team, if your football team makes it to the NFL Super Bowl, you want your quarterback, your running backs, and your wide receivers to play really well, don't you? Why? Because they're going to score the touchdowns. And if they win the game, everybody wants to interview the quarterback, the running backs, or the wide receivers. That's like the evangelist. So to use the metaphor, if God is at work scoring touchdowns, it's to share the gospel. It's going to be the quarterback, the running back, and the wide receivers who catch those things, score the touchdown, and we celebrate, celebrate, celebrate. That's evangelism. The work I do now is to teach the offensive linemen. The work I do now, I'm not an evangelist anymore. I'm actually a person who actually teaches people how to block. But if you win the football game, who is the most important person on the field? It's the blockers. Because if your quarterback doesn't have time to throw the pass, you don't win. If your wide receivers don't have time to get open, you don't win. And so in that sense, this talk that I'm going to give you today is not evangelistic. We're not going to talk about doing evangelism. We're going to talk about using our temporal liberties to block, to keep the church publicly free to share the gospel. So God is at work. You remember that phrase, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's? That's a biblical teaching. If you have friends who are secularists and they say, I believe in separation of church and state, what do you say to that? I believe in separation of church and state. You know what you say? I didn't know you were a Christian. That's what you say to them, because that's a biblical idea. Now, we don't use the word separation, and if you do use the word separation, it's okay as long as you put the state on the bottom. If you put the state on the bottom and the church on the top, and the church is being protected from the state, then I'm okay with the word separation. We use the word differentiation, because God works through the state to keep things from breaking loose, all hell from breaking loose, and God works through the church to save. He preserves, he saves. It's a biblical idea. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Jesus said that. Because God has work to do through Caesar too, but it's very limited work. And then give to God what is God's. And then talk to them about how God is at work. In fact, if you look in the Bible, what's the main purpose of the state? What's the main role of the state? Anybody know? Yeah, just to actually enforce the law, to make sure the bad people don't get away with publicly being the worst we can be, and good folks feel like that they're safe. That's it. That's Romans 13. The notion that the state should take care of you is not a biblical notion. Your family should take care of you. You should take care. God should take care of you. Your church should take care of you. Free people take care of themselves. And so again, we're going to talk a little bit about that. But just understand, from the Bible's point of view, God is at work through Caesar, even though it's a very limited work. And then, of course, God is at work bringing you to faith, to kingdom, preserving and saving. Okay? And so we're going to talk about how we interact with Caesar today, even though that's God's work too. If you want to know more about us, lcrlfreedom.org, lcrlfreedom.org. We got all kinds of information there for you, so go there after this time. And again, email us if you've got any questions, because we're here to serve you. So I'm in Washington, D.C., protecting our church. That's the main thing I do, okay? All right, let's just jump into it. It's easy to be brave from a distance. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, I just wish the world would calm down and then we could get about our business of being the church. It's never going to be that. It's always going to be chaotic. It's always going to be this way. I've been a pastor in New York City. I've been a pastor in South Central Los Angeles. Some of you know that I was the Lutheran Hour speaker, and now I'm in Washington, D.C. I want you to know that it's always going to be chaotic. Because the world is broken. God's going to preserve it so all hell doesn't break loose. So you can do what? Share the good news of the gospel. That's the only solution to the issues that we have. Before we get into this work about the state, let me ask you the question. What is it that you Lutheran people have? If you were to tell me, you know, we're at this youth event today, and this is an evangelism question. What is it that you have that I need? You have a Savior who comes all the way to where I'm at to deliver the good news of the gospel to me. I used to lead a Bible study on Wall Street. And Wall Street's not, it's not the most faithful place. Let me just say it this way. When the stock market was up, the Bible study was down. When the stock market was down, the Bible study was up. So people came in there, and we wound up leading the Bible study for a while. And they asked me one time, hey, Sells, what makes Lutherans different? So all these different denominations are in there. All these different people are in there. Some of them are not even Christians, are in the Bible study. And they ask you, what makes your teaching or your church different? And you got about 15 seconds. What would you say? Here's what I said after many times of saying it wrong. I said to him, hey, do you know 2,000 years ago there's Jesus? He literally came. He's the Savior of the world. And he lived, he died, and he rose again for all of us. Did you have anything to do with that, I said to them. They said, no, he did it all for us. Good. Yeah, I believe that too. Okay, well, what makes you people different then? And here's what they said to me. They said, if you would just give up your view of the Lord's Supper and give up your view of baptism, we could all be the same. That's what they said to me. So here's what I said. Well, that same Jesus who came all the way and did it all for us, and we didn't do any of it, he still comes all the way to where you are through words, water, bread, and wine to let you know that what he did all the way back then, he's still doing all the way just for you. So where you need to hear that he did it all for you, he comes through words. When you get to read it, you get to hear it. He literally splashes it all over you when he puts his name on you in baptism. And actually when you come to the Lord's Supper, he says, taste and see, I am good. I'm delivering it. Everywhere you need to know you're loved, he comes. And so the Jesus that I said, baptism's not what Lutherans teach. Baptism's who Jesus is. Lord's Supper's who Jesus is. He's the one who comes all the way to where we are through words, water, bread, and wine to let us know he did it all for us. And what they said to me that day, I'm going to tell you, they said, we've never heard about that Jesus. And you hear about it every Sunday. So I've been in some of the craziest places, most chaotic places in our country to serve, and the gospel does its work. That's what you have. Now, today, I'm not going to talk about sharing the gospel. That's evangelism. I'm going to talk about the work of protecting your right to share the gospel. Okay? But know what you have first, because when it's all said and done, that's our answer, this Jesus. All right, so have you heard stories like this? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, have you heard these stories? The question is, Daniel and the lion's den, Esther. So this is a man and a woman thing. I don't care how old you are, I don't care how young you are, this is all of us, all hands on deck. If you remember the Esther story, basically, Mordecai says to Esther, you got to go talk to the king because they're going to actually come after us. And Esther says, if I go to the king, I mean, he could kill me. I don't have the right to do that. And he said, you need to, because God's people need to be protected. Now, if you read these stories, what's the tension in these stories? Yeah, I mean, the children of Israel, the Jewish people at this time, could be wiped out. That's a bad thing. In the book of Exodus, they're in captivity. That's a bad thing. But that's just a small portion of the story. The point is, God made a promise in Genesis 3, right? Do you remember that promise? I'm going to send a Savior. He put that promise in a people. And he said, I'm going to actually put this promise in history so you can watch the promise come to fruition on Christmas morning. And so the point is, in these stories, the promise is going to be wiped out. So in the book of Exodus, what's the promise and the promised people? They're in captivity. If Satan wipes out the promise, that means you never know who Jesus is. So the tension in the Old Testament is the promise is in trouble. The promise is in captivity. The promise could get wiped out. And so basically Mordecai says, you have a responsibility to defend the promise. I love what Esther says. She said, all right, I'll do it. Do you remember the phrase though? She said, I'm going to go to the king, but if I die, I die. There are some things that are worth living for, and there are some things that are worth dying for. And I hope and pray you understand that your faith is one of those things. So again, Esther, you got to go do this because the promise is something that God has given to us to defend. Same thing with Ezekiel. If you look at the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel's called the watchman. His job is to watch over things and to see when trouble is coming. And God says, if you see trouble coming but don't warn the church, the blood's going to be on your head. But if you warn them and don't listen, then you've done your job. What's interesting to me is that my name is Gregory, and watchman in Hebrew is Gregoreo. So I'm finally living up to my name. After all this time, after all the things that have happened in my life, I now realize I'm supposed to actually emulate the watchman of the Old Testament. But some of you are to be the watchman too. Some of you have the ability to block for the church. I'd love for you to figure out that with me. So Ezekiel, the question is, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all that stuff, can the church be in that kind of peril today? And the answer to that is yes. Who is this guy? Do you know who that guy is? Any history buffs here? That's Mussolini. Mussolini was a socialist, and if you know what socialism is, you're not taught this in school, but socialism is just an ideology that is at war with transcendence. And what I mean by that is the whole point of socialism is to say we don't need the church. That's the whole point. I don't care if it's national socialism, Nazism, or communism, or anything. It's a system that says there is no God, there's only the state. And so it's a battle against any notion of transcendence, of something being bigger than the state. That's it. And so right here, he is marching on Rome. That's what he's doing. He was going to destroy Rome. He was going to destroy the Pope, because if you destroy the Pope in Italy, then suddenly no one's looking to God for help anymore, because the Pope is a big deal in Italy. And so he's literally marching on Rome because he's going to reestablish a secular church called socialism. And in order to do that, you've got to wipe out the notion that there's a God who's bigger than all this. Well, he didn't succeed. He failed, which is why you don't read about Mussolini. Who do you tend to read about all the time? This guy. He's a national socialist. They're all kind of, like I said, it's different sides of the same coin. But same kind of thing. His goal was to knuckle the church under, to make it subservient to the state, and to make the state everything. And he believed in kind of the Darwin stuff, and he believed in survival of the fittest. He didn't think there was any God and all this kind of stuff. But the goal was to destroy the notion of transcendence. By the way, when I say transcendence, I know I'm talking philosophical terms, but what is the Declaration talks about transcendence. What does it say? You have unalienable rights because of what? Why do you have unalienable rights? Endowed by your creator, transcendence. If there is a God above, then you have individual rights. If they wipe the God above out of your life, which they're trying to do, then you have no unalienable rights. You have whatever the state tells you. That's the war. That's what's going on in culture today. Now, Hitler tried to do it. He also didn't succeed. But it's interesting. There's a book called Modern Fascism by Gene Veith. Gene Veith is actually, he taught at Concordia, Wisconsin. Gene's a good guy. He's been on my radio program a lot. And he's got a book called Modern Fascism. But look at the secondary title, Liquidating the Judeo-Christian Worldview. And that's happening today because, let me ask you the question, Hitler, the final solution, what was it? What's the final solution from Adolf Hitler? Anybody? Wipe out the Jews. Why do you want to wipe out the Jews? Okay, you're the first person who said that up front. They were a very, very religious people. They were defined by their book. The book was the Pentateuch, the Old Testament, and the main teaching of that was that God created them and they were part of God's promise. That's it. Now, most people, because you watch secular TV, think it was all about ethnicity. It was just because they weren't, you know, part of his supremacist view. No, they were people who believed in transcendence. And by the way, they think you Christians are part of the Jewish thing. Because you actually are people of the Judeo-Christian worldview. You actually believe there's a God above and that you have a relationship to him that's bigger than the state. And so the final solution was to wipe them out because they wanted to wipe that book off the face of the planet. So they wanted to wipe out the Bible's view of you. They wanted to wipe out the Bible's view that you were created by God, that you were created in his image, and that you had individual rights and responsibilities as God's people. That's what Hitler was up to. It wasn't just that he was a bigot. He was that, okay. And he was a supremacist. He was that. But those were secondary to the notion that he wanted to wipe out the notion that God created you. Well, you're the church that teaches this. You teach that God created you, and God redeemed you, and that God loves you. I was in the middle of the protests for the Roe v. Wade stuff, okay? And so we're going back and forth, and I'm talking to these people who disagree with us and everything about why life is precious and why life is sacred, even the life of that child, and why this is a good ruling and all that. But finally, I'm talking to this guy and this gal, and I looked at him, and I said, do you know why I'm here? And they said, you're here to protest. You're here to get your way. I said, no. I'm here to tell you that your life is precious too. I'm here to tell you that no state has the right to take away your life for no cause. Whether you're a little baby in the womb or whether you're a little bit older, because as we get older, we become less useful to society. Did you know that? You'll find that out pretty soon. And the young people say, what do we got all these old people around for? And people start saying, well, why don't we do some, you know, let's trim the evolutionary tree and let's get some, you know, survival of the fittest stuff going on here. Until we come and say, no, every life has dignity. From the minute of your creation to the natural death. And so I looked at that person, I said, and I'm here fighting for you. Because I don't want the state to be able to define your life as not worth living. And you know, he kind of got a tear, and she got a tear in her eye. She said, we always thought our life had purpose, but we didn't believe that anymore. That's what you have. You're bringing that back into people's lives. And so you got to fight some of this stuff because these people are dangerous people. The people that we deal with today in our culture, I call them secular statists. They're not left-wing people. You know, you hear liberal, conservative. Liberals and conservatives are people who still believe in the Constitution. They still believe that God created us. They just have different views of how they get about that. These are people who don't believe there's a God. These are people who don't believe that there's any limitation and that the state solves everything. We're fighting them on the Hill. Because they think the church is actually getting in the way. Okay? So, the God is Dead movement, is to me, I just want you to know, this is the same old thing. We've dealt with this kind of stuff every day of our life, whether we go back to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whether we go back to Ezekiel. This is just the way life is. And you're called to be in the middle of it. and to actually bring the good news of the gospel. So, do you believe in John 8, 31? What is more powerful force for good in the world? Is it the church or the state? Jesus says, if you abide in my word, you will know the truth, and the truth will. So freedom is God's thing, not America's thing. Freedom is God's thing. So he says, abide in me, know my truth, and the truth will set you free. If you believe that, then if somebody's at war with that, part of your job is to protect and to make sure that this word gets out so that everybody can hear. Would you rather live in a country that says you're free to do what's right? If you don't, we'll coerce you to do what's right. Or we might even coerce you to do what's wrong. Which place would you rather live in? Obviously, the first one, right? The trouble is you're not free to do whatever you want. You're free to do what is right. Then the question is, who defines that? God does. Okay? If you're free to do whatever you want, eventually they'll coerce you to do what they want. You cannot live a life that defies God's order of things and eventually not be under some kind of tyranny to the contrary. That's just the way life is. Okay? So the power of the state is the power to just keep things from all hell from breaking loose. It's a very limited power. God actually is at work through that. The power of changing hearts and changing lives, that comes from the gospel. That comes from the church. That comes from free people. Differentiate God's two kingdom work. A lot of people think America's arrogant. We're actually not very arrogant. The uniqueness of the American experiment is our founding documents that say that human beings have dignity, right? We teach that. A lot of people teach that, though. What's the other thing that the American experiment teaches that is so unique? They believe that we're created in the image of God, and therefore you have inherent dignity, but they also believe that we're sinful people. So Americans, when they founded America, they believed in the dignity of humanity and the depravity of humanity, which is why they limit the government. Because the last thing you want is sinful people to have power, unlimited power in your life. America is unique because they take the sinfulness of humanity seriously. So if someone says, you Americans are arrogant, you go, actually, we're not. We actually believe we're sinners. And we believe that the government needs to be limited. And we believe that our hearts need to be changed. And we freed those people, people whose hearts are changed, people to live freely. They live freely to honor God and to serve their neighbor. And that's what makes America unique. Okay? All right. So, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, would it happen? It happened then. We saw it happen, some of this in Western Europe. Is it happening in America? Are they trying to shut the church down here? How many of you know who this guy is? Walter A. My gosh, you didn't. How many of you know who Billy Graham is? Well, there's still people who know who. This guy was bigger than Billy Graham. In fact, when he passed away, Billy Graham applied to the Lutheran Hour because he was so in awe of Walter Meyer, and we told Billy Graham, now you got to be a Lutheran, sorry. But at the time, this guy was the number one radio preacher of the gospel in America. And back then, they didn't have TV, so they only had radio. The number one radio program, so think of TV, you know, radio was the TV of the time, right? And so the number one radio program that everyone in the nation listened to was The Shadow. And everybody sat by their radios and listened to The Shadow. So, I don't know, back in my day, there was a show called MASH. When MASH went off the air, it had 105 million people listen or watched it. 105 million. The Shadow had several millions of people listening to it, too, on radio. And guess which the number two program was at that time? The Lutheran Hour. So if you can imagine the Lutheran Hour coming on after MASH on television, that's how big it was at one time in this culture. And this guy was an LCMS pastor. His name was Walter A. Meyer. There's a book out now about radio that actually talks about Fulton Sheen and Walter Meyer as the two most significant pastors of that early radio period. And he's of your church. So my point is this guy was, he was out there, he was preaching the gospel, he was an evangelist, but in 1942, they tried to kick him off the radio. Now, they tried to kick him off the radio because they said he preached too much about Jesus. Isn't that something? I thought everybody was a Christian in 1940. They try to kick him off because he preached about Jesus, Jesus, only Jesus. And my question is, what should Walter Meyer have done? They complained to the FCC. They said he shouldn't be on the radio. They should take the Lutheran Hour down. So should Walter Meyer say, well, that's the government. We don't deal with government. What should we do? He actually defended the Lutheran Hour to the FCC. But he didn't talk about the Bible. He talked about the First Amendment freedoms we have. Jeffersonian First Amendment protections of the church. And he argued that radio should actually have a spot for our preaching. He helped start the National Religious Broadcasters, which is the largest First Amendment organization for the church, dealing with television, radio, and internet. We started it. The Lutheran Church started it. And for those of you who know what the LLL is, one of the first presidents of the NRB was an LLL guy. So my point is, he was one who used God's protection, First Amendment protections, to keep the gospel of the Lutheran Hour on radio, and it's still on radio years after. I was the eighth Lutheran Hour speaker. But if he doesn't fight to protect us, that goes off the air and probably never comes back. We need to block like that today too, okay? So Walter Meyer, get to know his, you could be a Walter Meyer. You could be not just a, if, you know, maybe not many people get to be the Lutheran Hour speaker, many people get to be radio preachers and stuff like that, but those who know how to block for the church, to keep the church's public voice in the public square free, you guys know how to do that. I know lawyers who are helping us. I know entrepreneurs who are helping us. I know people who deal with government all the time who are helping keep the church's public voice free. Keep your preschools and your schools free to proclaim the whole counsel of God. All right, so today I'm just going to talk really quickly then about what it means to be this two-kingdom person, to jump into the things of culture. And Romans 12 was one of my favorite verses. Therefore, in view of God's mercy, present your, does anybody know the verse? Present yourselves or your bodies. Present your bodies as living sacrifices. So does anybody not have a body here? Okay, good. All right. Yeah, jump in. But if we're going to jump into this stuff, we're going to jump into the cultural stuff, we've got to know the waters in which we're swimming. You know, we don't just jump in and say, let's see what happens, because it could be rocky. It could be torrential. So we jump in knowing. We want to be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. We want to see how God is preserving the world and how God is saving the world. And we want to be useful in His hands. Okay? So present-day realities, I'm not going to talk about this. I just want to ask the question, should we engage? If you want to read about what's really going on out there, there's a book called Culture Wars by James Davison Hunter. There's another book called Get Out Now, What's Going On in Our Public Schools. We're in a culture war. A lot of people don't think Christianity, they actually think Christianity is the problem. So we're in a war with that. That shouldn't scare you. I don't care whether we win that war or lose that war. I care whether we engage that. And who are we engaging it for? Not just for the sake of the church. We're engaging it for the sake of the people that disagree with us, because we want them to know of the God who created them and redeemed them as well. This happened. I was in Washington, I'm there to obviously represent our church, advocate for our church. I was on an immigration board, okay? And that's a pretty contentious topic, right? You know that. So I'm on this board, and I'm supposed to talk about why the church, what's the church's view on this stuff. And we got Democrats and libertarians and Republicans in there. We got people, we have senators and congressmen, we have staffers in there. Finally, at the end of this whole thing, this one kid gets up and says, "This is such a contentious topic. How are we going to ever come together as a nation?" Good question. Before I could answer, the rabbi on the panel with me jumped up. Now listen to what he said. Ready? Do you agree with this? He said, if we all start treating each other as made in the image of God, we can start. Now, how do you think that room, now these are politicians, how do you think that room reacted to the rabbi's statement? Boo. What do you think? Dumbstruck silence. That's what most people think. Standing ovation. Wait a minute, I thought that we were taught that all this talk about image of God stuff, I thought we were told that that's wrong and that's bad and it's all that. Not to the people who really know how things work. That whole room stood up and clapped. Well, then, of course, I had to ruin the moment, right? I had to raise my hand. Here's what I said right after that. I said, you know, I agree with the rabbi. What he said is absolutely right. But he can't say that outside of this room. He can't say that at any major university. He can't say that at a public university. He can't say that in a public policy meeting. He will be drowned out with boos. Why are you all standing and clapping? I said, that's the problem, that we can't say this out there. But man, I want to tell you, even behind the scenes, they're like, will someone just stand up and say this? Because we know that's the solution. Okay? So the cool thing is, I'm just saying, engage it, kids. Don't shrink back from this. This message is powerful. When you tell someone that their life is purposeful, that God created them, and that they have an eternal destiny, they're like, what? We don't learn that anywhere anymore, except in church. And so again, should we engage it? Absolutely. Here's why I think it's important. This is a guy who's teaching public policy at Berkeley. I got to go through this pretty quickly because I don't want to run over. Okay. He was big up in politics at one time. Now he teaches public policy at Berkeley. Listen to this quote. The true battle of the 21st century will be between the modern society and the anti-modernists. Who does he think you are? Anti-modernists, okay? And he goes on to say, between those who believe in the primacy of the individual, that's him, at least he says that, and those who believe that we have an allegiance and identity that's related to a higher authority. Now, I could break down each one of these things evangelistically. We don't have time for that. But you could answer that right there by saying, wait a minute, if I believe in God, that was where the whole notion of me as an individual was born. So believing in God is what makes individualism possible. How come you don't believe that? Because the minute you get rid of the higher authority, you as an individual cease to exist. So we could debate him on every one of these topics, but that's not the point of this quote. Priority, those who believe that life is to be prioritized in this world, or those who believe that human life is a mere preparation for the existence of the afterlife. He's basically saying you Christians are so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. What's the answer to that? Have you ever met a person who doesn't believe, who believes that all life is whatever is happening today? They call that nihilism. Have you ever really met a nihilist? They're scary people because they don't think life has any meaning. Up to a little child, shoot them. They could step on a bug, do whatever they want because life has no meaning whatsoever. But if you meet someone who believes that life is eternal, that I'm going to have to actually answer to God, they actually live each day like it really matters. So I could even debate him on that. The next one, those who believe in science, reason, and logic, and those who believe truth is revealed through scripture and dogma. I was a science major at the University of Michigan. The scientific method is an outgrowth of the Christian worldview. We could debate them on that. That's what you got to learn how to deal with out there in evangelism. But the one thing I'm telling you that's scary is, see, at the end of his quote, he says, terrorism will disrupt and destroy our lives. Terrorism. But it's not the greatest danger we face. You are. He actually believes the Christian church, faithful to the scriptures, is more dangerous to America than terrorism. I'm telling you, I got to fight that. I'm not going to let him caricature you guys like that. I'm not going to let him create laws that make our voice illegal in America, but that's what he thinks. This was an op-ed in the New York Times. This was an op-ed in the Washington Post. This is a common view in our universities today. We've got to fight that because there's a book called What If Jesus Were Never Born? You should read that book, What If Jesus Were Never Born? By D. James Kennedy. It's a real easy book to read. It talks about how the dignity of children, the dignity of women, the dignity of family, universal education, all these things happen because of Christ and Christ, the Christian worldview. Because before that, none of those things existed. And so read that book to talk about what positive things you now enjoy just because we engage this. He really believes that the state can replace the church and will still live beautiful lives. All right, so jump in. It's Robert Reich. If you know who Robert Reich is, he's Labor Secretary of Bill Clinton. He's now teaching at Berkeley. But this is, I don't usually use his name. This is a common view in the public universities, okay? And they look at the Christian worldview as the enemy of progress. And we have to defend the fact that the Christian worldview created the very progress we enjoy. And also that the Christian worldview is a legitimate voice in the public square. Okay? All right, so we're going to go pretty quickly now. The power of being a two-kingdom citizen is you get to be a part of this. God is at work. Remember, it's not. I'm not telling you to do something that he isn't already doing. The question is, can I be useful in his hands? Some of you know how to block. Some of you are going to be now, like my work in D.C., you're going to keep the church's public voice free. But then the rest of you got to do what? You got to share the public voice of the gospel. You got to share Christ in the public square. So we work together to do this. God preserves, God saves. God preserves, God saves. We just want to be faithful to him. And by the way, all hell, it can get worse. I mean, if we don't participate in God's saving or preserving work, life can get worse. I've been in urban ministry all my life. I think I've told you this. New York, L.A., if you destroy the family... If you destroy the family, all hell breaks loose in the community. It's the number one problem in the city today, the public policy destruction of the family. Let me give you an example, like this two kingdom stuff and how we Lutherans argue. How about the defund the police? You know, you hear that all the time. We must defund the police. What's the Lutheran response to that? Well, let me say it this way. How many of you would love to have a police car on every street in your neighborhood? Would you love to have a cop? You would? I don't know if I would. We're limited government people, right? So I need police, but I don't want a bunch of them. How many of you have those signs in your neighborhood that show you how fast you're going? What if you went too fast, you got a ticket immediately? Would you love to live in that neighborhood? Every time your car went too fast, you got a ticket in the mail? Man, that's like a police state. Who wants that, right? Well, here's the point. If you want less police, you have to have stronger families. They're in an inverse relationship. Because right now, most problems in the city are being caused by 13 to 20-year-old boys high on testosterone. When I was your age, I did some pretty stupid things until my dad said, "You're my son, you're not doing that, and if you do, you got to answer to me." Now, when you got a dad like that in the home, you don't need as many police out on the street. And so if you have less police, which I don't want a lot of police in my neighborhood, because I occasionally go too fast and I prefer not to always get a ticket every time. I don't want to live like that. But if I've got less police, I have to have stronger families. If I have weaker families, we need more police. That's the way it works. The people we're dealing with on the Hill want to destroy the police and destroy families. We can't do that because that's chaos. So that was our solution. And I had people who even disagreed with us about some of this and said, "We like how you Lutherans talk about that. Because we like how you're saying we want limited police force. Well, if we have limited, then we got to incentivize the family. Help us do that." Isn't that neat? So sometimes we talk and both sides listen to us. And that's a good thing. Because we know that the government's not going to save us. That's God's preserving work. But it actually can keep all hell from breaking loose. So we engage for the sake of the culture and for the church. All right, real quickly, this is our theme verse. You are people who are already set you free. Who set you free? Jesus Christ set you free by his life, his death, and his resurrection. So God says, live as people who are free. The first rule of this is the government never grants you freedom. You are already free in Christ. This government in America is supposed to undergird your freedoms. That's a beautiful thing. A lot of other governments don't. But you happen to live in a country that says freedom is precious and we will guard it for you. So live as people are free, no matter where you live. Don't use your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but live as servants of God. Here it comes. Honor everyone. Honor is a respect word. So when I work on the Hill, I have people I disagree with very, very vehemently. But I need to learn how to honor them, be even respectful of them, treat them as if their life is precious too. That's what speaking the truth is not just for me, it's for them too. Honor, 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 even if you disagree. We could use a dose of that today, right? The second one, though, love the brotherhood. What's the brotherhood? The church. Love the brotherhood, love the sisterhood, love the believers, if you will. Why do you go to church? Anybody want to give me a quick answer? Why do you go to church? Anybody? Yes. For community, good. Let me ask it this way. You always like who's in that community? Yeah, here's the thing. You go to church to learn to love people you do not like. That's what makes the church unique. Because the church is gathered by Jesus. You know, you're going to go to church one day, and that person's going to be sitting in your pew, and you're like, that's my pew. You need to get out of there. And you're going to find people, you're like, that guy's in our church? I don't like that guy. The church is gathered by Christ, and you need to then learn how to love one another the way Christ loves you. Every other relationship, every other organization you join because you like the people. The church is the one where you're gathered, and you need to learn to love those you may not even like. That's what makes it unique, and that's why Peter says, love the brotherhood. It's the most unique organization in the world. Don't love the state. Don't love those other organizations. Honor those and be a part of those, but love the brotherhood because that's where Christ is at the center, and Christ can hold you together. Then he says the third thing, fear God, because God is the one in charge of all this. How about this last phrase? What do you think that if you were a first century believer, what would that phrase have meant to you? Honor the emperor. Caesar was literally putting people to the stake. He was hanging people up and lighting them on fire. He was crucifying Christians. And Peter still says, but learn to honor his work. Don't agree with it. Learn how to use your freedoms to push back if he's wrong, but you're not supposed to be the insurrectionists that destroy the order that God uses to keep the peace. Wow. Man, I'll tell you, if I was a first century Christian, I would have said to Peter, are you crazy? Honor the emperor? That's left-hand kingdom-preserving work. We have to learn how to honor the forces that God puts in the world to keep all hell from breaking loose. And then we have to hold it accountable to what God says it's supposed to do. All right. So engage the world Esther style. Engage the world Ezekiel style. Learn how God engages the world. Differentiate that and jump in. All right, I'm going to go really quickly here. So this is the kind of work we do. We focus on God's preserving work in this left-hand kingdom work, this blocking work. We engage the culture for the sake of the culture, not just for the sake of the church. And then finally, this last one, we ask the right engagement questions for this kind of work. Well, what are those questions? Do you know this when people say WWJD? What does that mean? Yeah, what would Jesus do, right? That's usually the question you should ask for evangelism. What would Jesus do? You know, Jesus said, turn the other cheek. Okay. Give them the shirt off your back. Okay. If they need you to walk 1 mile, walk two. Do whatever it takes to serve the good news of the gospel into their life. That's what Jesus would do. That's the wrong question to ask of government and policy. Government and policy is what would the Father have us do to preserve the world so we can do that work of Jesus. So we ask in our work, WWFD, what would the Father have us do? And that's questions like, honor your father and your mother. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. If you won't work, you don't eat. That's the kind of questions you ask of government and preserving work. Or this last one, we have a paper on this called WWJRD. What would Jesus really do? And he would tell you, do whatever the Father tells you. Because he came to fulfill the Father's work. So again, differentiating this work between God the Father's preserving work and him sending his Son, that's something we Lutherans really understand. There's a tension in that. We ask the right questions of the things we're dealing with. All right, let me get to this. So this two kingdom voice, remember I've been talking about this word differentiates, separates, differentiates church and state. It differentiates God's actions, which puts politics in its proper place. Politics will not save you. I don't care how good politics gets. We might elect all the right people. All we're doing is electing good people to preserve, to put the proper barriers in life so that all hell doesn't break loose. How many of you drove? What freeway comes into this place? Is it 45? 610? How many of you, when you're driving, did you drive here the speed limit? Okay. If you're driving down the freeway, they got this huge barrier down the middle. Isn't that terrible? They got a barrier there. Aren't barriers bad? When people put barriers into our life, aren't they terrible? Well, actually, if you drive on a two-lane road with those two little yellow lines and you're going 65 this way and 65 that way, if you jump that yellow line and hit another person head-on, that's a 130-mile-an-hour accident. You're dead. So now what we do is we put barriers down the middle. And if you run into that barrier, you're going to hit it, and you're going to come back into the traffic, but you probably come back in for, it might be a 20-mile-an-hour, maybe a 40-mile-an-hour crash. You live. So if you put the proper barriers, it keeps all hell from breaking loose. That's what politics is. So good politics can save us, but bad politics can destroy us. So we're in D.C. to make sure bad politics doesn't happen so that you can be free to share the gospel. Okay? And then finally, this last thing, I think this is what you kids are going to have to deal with going forward. You live in a world today where this phrase, God's created order and his moral ordering of the world, that's being redefined as hate speech. There was a bishop in Finland who was put on trial by the government because he taught that marriage was between a man and a woman. He was put on trial, went all the way to their highest court. He was exonerated, but of course they're suing him again. And if he loses, he will be an enemy of the state. He will serve 2 to 4 years in prison, and he will be fined hundreds of thousands of dollars for merely teaching the Bible's view of marriage. What? Now, I'm from Finland. My grandparents are from Finland. And the Bible is actually an official book of the Finnish people. It's actually an official book. So they asked the attorney general, well, if the Bible is this hate speech book now, why do we have it in all of our libraries? Here's what she said. She said, well, you can read it, but you can't believe it. Now, that's in a Western culture. They call it ethnic agitation laws. Well, we have a law like that right now in America called the Equality Act. It's basically the Anti-Traditional Christian Act. And it will bring what I call secular blasphemy laws to America. Or if you believe in marriage, we were told that you can have your view of marriage, they can have their view of marriage, and we'll just live in peace. That's not the way it's working out in law. They're saying if you believe that view of marriage and your school teaches that view of marriage or your church teaches that, we will have the attorney general come for you too. And so we pushed back on that and said you don't have the right to do that. Not in a free society. Okay? I don't care what your view of marriage is at this point. Actually, you know, obviously I do. But I'm saying, I don't really care what your view of marriage is. That's not what the government should be doing. It should not be deciding who gets to have their view of marriage and who doesn't in a free society. In fact, what's the Lutheran argument against gay marriage? Anybody know? See, we need to learn how to actually argue our perspective. Here it is. It was argued before the Supreme Court. This whole issue about marriage is not so much what's your view of marriage, it's what's the state doing involved in this. That was the main issue. And remember, does the state grant rights or does the state undergird rights you already have? Which one? It undergirds rights you already have. They don't grant rights. Don't let them tell you they do. So the notion that the state grants rights to a man and a woman and gives them the right of marriage, that's actually not what's going on. The state only can take rights away from you. So why would they take the rights of a man and a woman away from them and make them sign a contract called marriage? That's the first question. What's the answer to that? Anybody? Kids. Yeah. They don't want to raise you're the only relationship that can go to sleep tonight. That's one of the reasons why we don't want you just to live together. A good society cannot have people just living together, having kids, and not raising them. That would be a chaos. And so the government says we can't have chaos. We'll make them sign a document called marriage. We'll reduce their rights. They won't be able to just break that union apart because that's the only one that could go to sleep tonight and wake up tomorrow and have a citizen. Physiologically, it's the only relationship that can. Everybody else has to go outside of their relationship to have children. So the state should limit its nefarious activity of taking rights away just to a man and a woman. That was our argument. And we said, and if the state can't limit its nefarious activity to a man and a woman, it should get out of the whole marriage business. I had gay activists who said, I disagree with your view of marriage, but I like your view of what the state should be doing. That's you. That's you in the public square arguing for the proper ground floor of civility so we can all live together. And then sharing the gospel as the only solution. But I'm saying that we actually then defend why marriage is important. We defend all the things about why it's so important to our society, all these kinds of things, but we're not going to let the state define other rights that are crazy, that are undermining all this stuff, when that's not their role to play. So God's created order, and his moral ordering is a beautiful thing. He created you male and female. That's beautiful. He limits our activity. He creates us to do the right thing. That's a beautiful thing. And right now you're being told it's an ugly thing. I try to use metaphors to help you do this. There's a guy named Chesterton. He said this. He said, when I was young, and he was agnostic, I think, in England. For those of you who know who C.S. Lewis is, Chesterton is kind of the guy that Lewis read to become a Christian. So Chesterton, you should read Chesterton. He said, I hated the church when I was young because it seems like they put up barriers everywhere. And I didn't like barriers. Until I realized that where God told the church to put those barriers, it was so that freedom could run wild. And so the image that the Bible paints of God putting up barriers, it's not to curb your enthusiasm. It's not to actually make life harder on you. It's to actually allow freedom to run wild in your lives, the beauty of God's creation to run wild in your lives. So think of the Mustangs on the plane as they're running. Well, if you have fences where the cliff is, those Mustangs will bump into it, but they keep running, and the wind is blowing through their manes, and they're running wild and running free. You take those fences down, they go over the edge. You turn the lights off, they stop running. So again, God turns on the light, God puts in the proper barriers, because he wants freedom to run wild in your life. You have to convince your friends that that's what those barriers are doing. Okay? All right, so are you on the team? I guess what I've been talking about is in evangelism, we're always talking about these guys, the running backs. I'm saying, will you be one of these guys? Look at that work. By the end of the game, they're like, oh my gosh. I mean, they just get pounded every play. But if they do their job and they do it well, these guys run free. These guys actually accomplish the goal of sharing the good news of the gospel, okay? Let me just go to this last thing here. Oops. No, that's not. You can listen to our radio program. This is basically what I've been trying to teach you. You see this pulpit right there? This is a pulpit in Germany, and what's underneath it? Can anybody see it? This right here, it looks like a knight. And the knight, it actually has a spear, and there are serpents literally coming up, and he's doing this all the time. He's keeping the serpents at bay so that the pastor, teacher, DCE can walk up to the pulpit and freely preach the good news of the gospel without fear of government coercion or interference. This is the person we're training at the Lutheran Center for Religious Liberty in Washington. We're training people who learn how to block so that people can share the good news. Last thought. Oh. What to do? Basically, be who you are, find your place on the team. What not to do not shirk your public responsibilities. You guys have been given an authority in America to actually tell Caesar what to do. The ultimate thing when you get involved in this stuff is just vote the platforms. Actually ask, what should the government be doing? And we limit the government's role in our lives so that we can keep the church free to proclaim the good news of the gospel freely. So that's what we should be asking. And there's no such thing as the concept of a benevolent government. There's benevolent church, there's coercive government. There's benevolent free people, there's coercive government. Benevolent government is merging this stuff and trying to say the government's a new church. And we're saying that's bad government and it's even worse church. So I'm going to stop here. Does anybody have any questions about this, about the work we do in Washington? We're your advocate. We advocate for religious liberty, the sanctity of life. Yes, in the back. Yeah, because I would say yes, because a lot of this stuff, the libertinism that we're dealing with in politics today, it started 150 years ago. So these folks have been at this for a long time. They're not going to stop. The Equality Act is something that the only way you can deal with it is to block it. I mean, this is not a dialogue. It's like in football. When you're playing the game, you got to block. And if you start dialoguing on the football field, you lose the game, okay? So this isn't a dialogue. This is about protecting the church's role in the world, and the Equality Act undermines the First Amendment. The Equality Act would gut the First Amendment. I'm just saying we can't let that pass. If we would have lost the last election and we would have had 51 secular status in the Democrat Party versus 49 Republicans, the Equality Act would actually be law today. That's how close it is. So I think we need to take that back. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think whenever you vote for government, that's a good thing. You're not voting for the good. You tend to be voting for the lesser of two evils. And you're also tending to ask, what is the government supposed to do? And the government's not supposed to do a lot of stuff in our lives. And so again, when you look at a platform that says the government will take care of you, that's usually a dangerous platform, okay? But usually when you vote, it tends to be lesser of two evils kind of stuff, okay? Yes. Top sources of funding, by the way, you could be one of them. That's it. I don't have anybody given. The only people that resource me are our church people. I'm not in any budget. Yeah, and that's good. It's actually a good thing because if we ever had a budget crisis in the LCMS, I'd be the first to go. Yeah, because, I mean, evangelism's the most important thing, right? But God has been good. He's been supporting us mightily through people like yourselves. Okay, yes. Okay.
Christianity has been a majority for a really long time. Why are we only hearing, I've never heard about this before. Why is this happening?
Well, we tended to abdicate our role. We were much more involved in this stuff back in the day, and I think we kind of let other people do it for us. I work with the Catholic bishops, I work with a lot of the evangelicals, but we have this unique voice, this two kingdom voice. We differentiate, and it's really a good voice on the hill, and so honestly, we should have been doing this all along. It's not that we're doing it because we're scared. We know God is at work. We are taking our responsibility more seriously in this left-hand kingdom work. But like I said, how many people think the blocking coach is the most important person on the team? That's probably why, for a little bit, we just let it kind of fade away. But we're taking it seriously again. Well, we also have a Champions for Liberty group. We're developing Champions for Liberty churches around the country, and we're going to have people in every district to deal with the state-level stuff eventually.
You said you were in D.C., right?
D.C., yes.
Has the government ever, told you, the chance that you're, this D.C. is considered, not really Christian in a way? More liberal? Has the government ever said that they'll cut your funding at all?
Well, they can't cut our funding because we receive it freely. All right, everybody, God bless you, and I'll be around to answer questions up front if you want to ask questions up front. Thank you.